Hello, you're listening to Queer Everything, a queer of color podcast about thriving in the world while being at odds with it. I'm Lena Rafiq Sheikh.
I'm excited because of who it is, but also sad because of the circumstances to welcome back Ali, who spoke with us back in season one in episodes 9 and 10. If you recall, Ali is queer, Muslim, Palestinian, and currently lives in the United States. We recorded this on October 19th, about 12 days after a horrific surprise attack by Hamas on Israeli civilians, which has been followed by a brutal, ongoing series of indiscriminate bombings, civilian displacements, and the cutting off of necessary supplies like water and electricity to the population of Gaza. As I drop this, the Israeli military is on the precipice of a ground invasion, which has many of us fearing the worst for the people who live there. I asked Ali to join us and share some of his thoughts. Ali, hi.
Hi, Lena.
So Ali is joining us. I think you're in the car on your lunch break from work on today, which is Thursday, the 19th of October, which is about a week into this horrific sort of flare-up of, I don't even know what to call it anymore, the horrific violence that's been now being perpetuated in Gaza. And I invited Ali back to just tell us from his perspective what is on his heart, what is on his mind, and what he wants to communicate about his experience and also about what's happening more broadly.
Thank you, Lena, for the space and to be able to just share this. I think the purpose of me being here is to just put out my voice as a Palestinian, as a queer Muslim, as someone who lives in the States, that I think we shouldn't forget our humanity in all this. You know, at the start of October 7th, when all this happened and Hamas broke through the gates into Israel, I immediately felt dread because I knew what was to come. And I think it's important to note that Palestinians knew what was to come as well. And they still did it. For them, this kind of resistance and this fight to them is better than death because they're going to die anyway. And for them, it was expressed anger and frustration with the occupation that has been weighing on their necks for the past 75 years. As we all know, Gaza is in an open-air prison, and Israel controls all the inputs of its resources from water, electricity, and food and shelter and everything like that. And I feel like the events that have unfolded since, although extremely shocking, were not surprising to a lot of Palestinians, because I don't think the Israeli government, the current Israeli government, sees all lives as equal. And I think that's part of the problem, that Palestinian life is not seen as a life worthy of saving. We've heard it many times in their rhetoric describing us as no innocent victims, you know, or us as human animals, which is rhetoric that we've echoed in the past with many different cultures, many different ethnicities, and was used as an excuse for their extermination and genocide. Now it's being flipped on, and I think it's challenging for the world to see it for what it is playing out, because inherently it's hard for us to relate to someone that we perceive as other. When we give them the definition of animal, we take away everything that makes them human. And I think that's what Israel has been doing and continues to do since the beginning of its creation.
Yes. So you are in the United States right now, and that is a particular vantage point from which to be watching and experiencing what is happening. How are you holding up? How are you doing? And what is happening around you?
So I'm extremely lucky. I have a very solid queer Muslim community that has been a great source of help, queer Arab community that has been a great source of relatability, where I've reached out to people who are just like me, Palestinians in the States, and kind of deep, because it's also traumatized, watch all this unfold. But even in our own homes, in our backyards, we see the ramifications of all this rhetoric that's being peddled by Western media. Just recently, a friend of mine and I went to a rally in Harvard Yards. We experienced what the Harvard students have been experiencing, which is pressure from their institution to kind of give up this fight for Palestinian rights. There has been doxing of students where their information and their faces were plastered on trucks and paraded around the Harvard schoolyards. There has been attempts from CEOs and people of power asking Harvard, or rather insisting that Harvard release the names of students that have signed petitions to end the siege on Gaza in order to not hire them. You know, so it's definitely this external attempt at intimidation that's being used. It's a white supremacist tactic to keep you silent, to prevent you from talking about this, to scare you into submission, which is what all fascists do. So I think that we're seeing this even now. Even in my own institution, obviously without saying names or where I work or what have you, we received a letter when all this started around October 9 that detailed atrocities that Hamas was committing and blatantly stating that our institution stands with Israel. And not once in this letter was Palestine even mentioned, or even any Palestinian. But just in that erasure, it kind of silences Palestinians from even trying to share their story and their experience, because they're already told that they're other and that it negates their truth. And I think that's where the harm comes. Just like with 9/11, when all that Islamophobia was being promoted, and it's happening again, where Palestinian and Arab voices are being silenced and seen as anti-Semitic for just explaining or sharing their side of the story. And of course, this is generalizing. It's obviously not all of Western media or Western, like, white Jewish spaces or even just white spaces. It's just, it seems to be second nature in this country to just pick a side. Yeah, it's just eye-opening when you see that all the imagery that's being sent out from Gaza is being ignored, you know, and that the truth instead is being perceived to be what the government is telling them. And I just think that has happened many times before, and at least people on the ground are fed up. A lot of the people that I associate myself with are fed up. So part of me hopes for a different time where we're able to make a change. But we've seen, you know, many attempts getting the government call for a ceasefire to no avail. So I guess I'm not sure what the future of this holds and what's going to happen next. And I'm just holding my breath waiting to see. But at least within our communities, there's a very strong solidarity that has always been there.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're in a place with community that has been my community as well. And in moments like this, it's been really important. I remember finding them around the time that the Pulse massacre happened. And even from where I am, I can feel how and the ways in which this moment is evoking 9/11, the suppression of dissent and people being afraid to express anything except a certain line. I've had people DM me and say, it's really hard to say anything and speak up. And, you know, even me as somebody who doesn't, I mean, I don't like social media. And in response to this, I realized we can't not post and publicize and spread the word, because it kind of feels like we're the only people who are doing it, people who are directly impacted. That's how the word is getting out. When we first got on the call, Ali, you mentioned that there was something that felt different about this moment in terms of what's being shared and how it's being shared. And I'm curious what your perception is of that.
Right. So, you know, if we look at American history, atrocities have always been committed. And I think the American public rarely, if ever, sees images of bodies being desecrated, mutilated, blown to bits. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, or if there's any other examples, but I think of as like the brutal killing of Emmett Till in the 1950s, where his mom insisted on an open casket and insisted to show the world that this is what they did to my son, and to have a public funeral for that reason. I think shifted a perspective in the U.S. where these people were blind to the fact that these are real people being brutalized, you know? And now we have people on the ground in Gaza who are taking out their phones and taking these horrifying, horrifying images and videos of what's happening in hospitals, of what's happening in where they're being buried alive, people being pulled out of the rubble, things that the horrors I can't even describe.
I know.
Especially in those who make it out, you know, I see videos of like kids crying with their dead parents next to them. I can't help but think like, what's happen to that child if they survive? You know, if they make it, how will they recover the trauma? You know, like, and those images, at least in me, evoke a very strong empathy. And in part, I can say it is because I am Palestinian, I am Arab, so I do empathize. There is that part of me that does wonder, is it just a little more difficult for white people to see that, for people of different ethnicities even to relate? Because all of us can agree that is horrifying and no kid should go through that. And yet there's been a justification of the murder of more than 1,000 children already in Gaza. There was an outcry for 40 imaginary beheaded babies with no even video or imaging proof of that, you know? And not to say it's not horrifying to think about, but it's, if you were so wounded by the idea of 40 babies being beheaded, then where is that same level of empathy for the documented 1,000+ children that have been murdered during this attack? And it just, I can't help but think, do some people feel differently about the value of life in terms of Palestinian versus otherwise? And that just digs deep into your own biases and your own subconscious way of thinking. Do you actually perceive Palestinians to be less deserving of life? Do you actually see them as not innocent by virtue of being Palestinian? Which is a lot of what the rhetoric from the Zionist regime is churning out. You know, all it takes is to look at these images, to see the fear in the people's eyes, to see the trauma, you know. There was a press conference that was held by physicians after the bombing of the hospital where 500 Palestinians were killed. And in it, one of the doctors, a plastic surgeon, gave a speech. And you can see in his eyes the trauma, you know, of having seen what he saw and knowing that he needed to still speak. This person was here saving lives and he needed the world to see. He conducted that press conference amidst a sea of dead bodies. And that was very perfect because intention was to show the world the hellscape that they experience on a day-to-day basis. And still, sometimes that is not enough. Still, people hold their tongue from condemning Israel, which to me is astonishing. I want to know what it must feel like to be silent, or why people choose silence over condemning a country that has blatantly stated that they are going to commit genocide and have done so unchecked with the full support of the United States of America.
I think a lot of people are sitting with varying degrees of shock. My response to what has been happening the past few days has been deep disappointment and also not surprise. And I have to say the bar was low in terms of what I expected from the US. And wow, it is really, really fucking low.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we all know this, but like the US was the only country in the Security Council to veto a bill to for a ceasefire just to bring aid into Gaza. And again, that's not surprising, but I guess I shouldn't expect better. I mean, we all knew who Biden was. He's mentioned many times that he's a Zionist, and whether or not he's a Jewish person, he thinks that the best investment the U.S. has ever done was creating the Israeli, or helping create the Israeli state and funding it year after year, giving them billions of dollars. So I understand that there's maybe more at play here that we don't know about, like maybe some kind of, not be like my dad, but like some conspiracy of someone pulling the strings and wanting things to play out the way that they are. But I can't help but think there has to be something going on, because how do you switch off your moral how do you okay the carpet bombing of civilians? And whether or not Hamas is entrenched within civilian lives in Gaza, that does not give you an excuse to then punish innocent lives. I mean, part of international law is that collective punishment is against it and is a war crime. That's documented. Time and time again, Israel keeps describing collective punishment and saying, we're going to keep bombing Palestine or Gaza until Hamas turn themselves over, until they release the hostages. That's illegal. Like, that is illegal. Whether or not they will admit it, the international stage has said that many times, and still the U.S. will never condemn them. And we've heard during the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, The UN took a hard stance at saying that cutting off water, electricity, and resources to a nation is a war crime. Mm. And now that it's happening to Gaza, crickets.
Yeah.
And again, yeah. It's the picking and choosing of what lives matter that I think is the issue. I'm not here to tell you, oh, Israel is bad, Palestine's good, or vice versa. You know, all life lost is life lost, and all life is precious. Or in the Israeli lives that were killed during the October 7th attack, but there is no symmetry. You know, mm-hmm. when you compare the Palestinian casualties over the years, there's some great graphics actually that I've mm-hmm. seen, I think, New York Times maybe, where they show the deaths of Palestinians versus Israelis year by year, and always it's out of proportion. And mm-hmm. I'm left wondering, you know, what is the amount of life that's going to be needed for this to end? This time, you know, there's always a point where they're like, okay, this is enough, we're satisfied. Mm-hmm. It's like, but mm-hmm. that's never a solution. It has never led to peace, has never led to justice. Palestinians just end up getting more frustrated with the system that they're forced to live in, and the cycle continues. So it's it's frustrating to watch again.
So I tend to, and this is my way, I have tended to, since 9/11, just avoid discussions that involve me defending my humanity, the humanity of people like me, right? Mm. Whether that's because when we're discussing at that level, that's not a kind of discussion I can engage in. I can talk about facts, I can talk about analysis. And if we're talking about basic humanity, that's not work that I can do in a serious conversation with somebody. It's not a conversation that happens in good faith. And that's been a protective way of being for me. Mm. How has it been for you, especially since I know you've been in the States for less time than I have? You're younger than I am. I was here just after 9/11 and seen this unfolding over the past 20 years. How has it been for you, and how has it changed right now?
So I guess coming here, you know, I thought all my problems would be solved, especially my issues with sexual identity and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Tune in for the first podcast episode I was in. I think that with time, I'm learning that our biases do impact our relationship with the people we interact with, whether we like it or not. Mm-hmm. Like, I've made white friends who during these times are suspiciously silent, mm-hmm. despite the fact, you know, you claim that you care, mm-hmm. and you see my posts, you see my fervor, you see my urgency. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I expect them to reach out. It's just the fact that you choose to ignore it. Mm-hmm. I even had someone who I know looks at my stories message me randomly being like, hey, do you want to go on a hike? And I was like, are you kidding, dude? My country's being bombed. Right now. Like, I don't have the mental space for this. And thanks for checking in. You know, like, it's crazy, the audacity, I guess, that they think that I'm posting this for fun, shits and giggles, but obviously it's impacting me. So I just think there's a disconnect sometimes. And it's disappointing to see when you realize that you're playing a character in their book, and it's not that they see you as a person. So when that happens, I try to give myself time and spaces that I know I'm seen as a human, which are like queer Muslim spaces or just Muslim spaces or Arab spaces in general. And I then come back into the mode where I'm like, okay, even though obviously we're experiencing so much grief right now, it sucks that we have to still educate people. Sometimes I do feel like it's the least I can do, because I am privileged, and the fact that I'm here in the States and I'm not by virtue of not being born in Gaza. So I do want to kind of invoke that humanity. And I don't know what led me to this point, but when I think that certain Zionists have this perception that Palestinians don't see them as people, when in reality, I see you. Like, I know you're real. I know you have a life. I know you have interests and hobbies outside of killing my people. It's just that you don't see me as someone who thinks other than hate, you know? And I don't know if that's a generational trauma response for them, But I sometimes try to bridge that gap discussion where I just kind of explain that, you know, my own personal experiences with discrimination and injustice in Palestine and here. And sometimes they get it, sometimes they don't. And honestly, with time, like with time being here, I've learned to not need the validation of others, especially white people. So as soon as I feel like the vibe is off, I'm okay cutting you off completely. Even though, and that's a selfish thing to do, because instead of putting in the work and like, sometimes I have to look out for me, and I don't think it's plausible for me to try to convince you that I'm a person. So yeah, I try to surround myself with people that I just know support my cause and my people and aren't just talking the talk. They actually walk the walk. And that's how I've been dictating my friendships, honest litmus test. What is your stance on, you know, and it's important that you do have a stance, because it's your taxpayer dollars that are funding the genocide of my people. So it's important to me that I know that you actually see it as a problem, and you're not just dismissive of it, or worse, silent and complicit in silence.
And then as a queer Palestinian, because I know that in online rhetoric, one of the thought stoppers is, oh, well, you know, if you lived over there as a gay person, what do you think would happen to you? Right? I can't tell you how many times I've seen that as an attempt to shut conversation down. And you and I both know, and we have talked about before, how one, that is vile and ridiculous, and two, it's much more nuanced than that. How would you respond to when people say that?
Right. So I feel very strongly about this. I mean, this is white supremacy at play. You, the white savior, are coming into my country and liberating me by murdering me. Thank you so much. You know, it's like, you're okay, so Israel is pro-gay. So then do their rockets like seek non-gay targets? I'm confused, because there's every kind of person, from child, man, woman, queer person, able-bodied, non-able-bodied, and you're telling me the rockets decide who they're killing? No. They're murdering everyone. So thank you for your concern, but like, your country is indiscriminately killing people and taking away their human rights, and you're telling me that I should side with them because they have queer parties? I mean, it's absurd. It's obviously absurd. And it's white supremacist ideal of the white savior that you're here to come and educate me and bring me diplomacy and democracy and, you know, spread your knowledge on your, on my people who aren't asking for it, and forcing it down our throats, and then acting like you're the victim when we don't want, just blows my mind. Like, for a white person to speak for me and tell me that I don't want to be in Palestine, it's like, you don't know what I want, you know? And Israeli queer spaces aren't exactly, what's the word, non-discriminatory, you know? You have to look a certain way, you have to be a certain way, you have to do even like the nuances of what it means to be a gay person in Israel as an Arab person, for example. There's still very hard discrimination, racism, despite what some people might say. And I know this from people I've spoken to, both Palestinian and Israeli, who are in Israel, who experience this kind of thing. And it's just, it's a cop when someone claims that a country has everyone's best interest when it, like, clearly doesn't. And I don't know how more to emphasize this other than say, well, you're, how can I agree with you when Israel is committing a genocide? Like, how, I want you to explain to me why being openly queer is more important to you than genocide. Like, that's there's not much else about that.
There's not much else to say. I think there's this false dichotomy, an increasingly false dichotomy, because I think a few years ago, that kind of argument was like, well, yeah, because there's so many more rights, or, you know, liberalism of a certain kind in the West. And all of that is falling apart and crumbling. It's not like LGBT rights, like West is exactly a paragon of it right now.
Right.
I don't know. It's just mind boggling. That's why I call it a thought stopper. It stops people from thinking.
Right. And it's like, you need to think more than that, because queer, I'm sorry, like, gay people, it's not just about queer rights. Like, patients now in Gaza who are on dialysis can't get dialysis. newborns that need to be in incubators can't. You know, like those dying, like those people, whether or not they're queer, not queer, whatever, they're never going to actually, it doesn't matter because they're being killed. Like, again, it's just surprising to me that people can overlook that and say, well, yeah, they're not white.
It's a dehumanization tactic. Yeah, it's an othering tactic, and exactly as you say. So for people who are seeing what's happening and are horrified and maybe don't know how to proceed, what do you wish you were seeing?
I wish I was seeing more voices speaking up. I wish I was seeing more reaching out to their local governments and government in general, trying to get the ceasefire going, because things can't keep going like this. Like, people should go to rallies, go to protests. There are links. You know, would you be able to provide them with that when this goes?
Yes,
arrives?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Just send me anything you want me to send. Yeah.
Yeah. To know where, you know, where to go, what to do, what to say. There's no excuse really for silence, because you have very prominent people putting their necks out on the line for Palestine right now who have nothing to do with it. Like, just off the top of my head, like singers even, like Kehlani, who's been more outspoken than most people I know, you know, and I'm like very impressed and taken aback by the strong Black movements that have been very pro-Palestinian. And it makes sense why that would be, as Palestinians have always been pro, like Black Lives Matter before it was quote unquote cool, you know. And it's the same with the Palestinian struggle. It's people need to understand that they don't want to be on the wrong side of, you know, they don't want to be on the side of genocide, on the side of silence. And I just think that people should speak up more. People shouldn't be afraid, because the worst thing that's going to happen to us is that we get into arguments with our families or arguments with our friends, or maybe losing a job, which sounds scary and intimidating. But the thing is that people are dying, you know, and everything comes secondary to that sole fact that human life is being lost. And an ethnic cleansing is underway. And I think people need to just realize that they have to speak up before it's too late.
Send me any links that you want to send. And then in terms of people getting informed, I've seen people who are afraid to speak out because they say, oh, I don't know very much about this. And how would you respond to that?
Right. I mean, there's also endless resources available, but by far, the thing that has been said is like the best thing to do is consume Palestinian music, consume Palestinian literature. You know, there are books out there by both Palestinian and Israeli authors or Jewish authors that do a very good job at explaining the situation. If you want to approach a historical lens, there's like nonfiction type of books, you know, that document the history and the context of the region. And then there are books that, which I think are more important, the ones that touch on, you know, what it's like to actually go through this kind of thing, like the journey of a family, or, you know, watching a movie about the Palestine-Israeli issue. And I think that's kind of what I'm holding on to most. And that's the thing that I'm educating myself about, is just keeping in touch with my roots and consuming as much Palestinian content as I can, where I just hold on to it, because my fear is that one day it's forgotten. So I think if all of us participate in absorbing this Palestinian culture that is very extensive, I think we would learn a lot and maybe create that humanity that we're missing. Because at the end of the day, we can empathize with someone's emotions and with their pain. You know, why is it that we can watch a movie about, you know, kids being drafted into a combat zone, Hunger Games, and we empathize with the characters there? And it's like we don't see the parallels with the dystopian society we currently live in, where there is an apartheid regime and it is subjecting a people lesser rights and lesser freedom. And we feel nothing about it, or at least people don't. So I think when you create that humanity, when you create an emotional link where you can feel each other's pain, feel each other's happiness, and understand that we're more than just our conflict or struggle, then that's when you realize that these people deserve freedom. I think that's what has to happen with Palestinian life as well.
So in the
organizational culture change model, the equity model that I teach, we have a one of the forms of so-called moderate oppression or implicit oppression, which is different from like what we used to call old-fashioned and now we call explicit, like racism, sexism, et cetera. Mm-hmm. One of the behaviors, one of the behavioral traps, we call it, is it's called avoidance of contact, where if I'm part of a historically advantaged group, I will have to make an effort to connect with people across difference, right? It's not going to be readily presented to me. And I think that's very much what we see, especially in the United States, around people having contact with, as you say, cultural material and, you know, movies and books and history from Palestinians, because it's just not readily available. Default, business as usual, you don't get that. And so I think I want to also lift up what you're saying as an encouragement to, if you don't want to perpetuate the oppression, if you don't want to be part of it, right? Part of disrupting it is engaging in actively seeking out those other perspectives and educating yourself and really putting in the effort to do that, because that's the only thing that is going to disrupt it. It's not going to present itself to you.
Right. And the reason why I also emphasize this is because the Zionist movement has always, always been afraid of this cultural empathy. Like me just wearing a Palestinian necklace sometimes gets me hate from people on the streets coming up to me saying, that's Israel. You know, like, because I have a necklace that is just the map of Palestine. It's just the map of the region. And it leads me to the point of the fact that this artifact that I have is so upsetting to you, the fact that me just showing my identity inversely like harms yours, then that must mean that you just don't want me to be perceived as a human. You don't want my identity to be out there. And so that's how I think that's the biggest form of rebellion, where we have our identity shown loud and proud to people. And I think media does a very good job of that. And if that's how it makes its way into the popular zeitgeist, where people are consuming that content, then it becomes undeniable and you can't suppress the Palestinian identity, you know, which I think for a long time has been seen as a form of rebellion to simply be Palestinian. So in that you see the discrimination and the racism and the, you know, the erasure that has been attempted on Palestinians and the shame and the silencing. And I think, like you said, it takes work and effort to break through part of the disruption.
What you bring to mind is all of the efforts around the US right now to suppress cultural material from particular outgroups. So right now in the news is how Scholastic Books, which is the purveyor of books to children's book fairs around the country, has omitted from its main category any books that, I guess, come under the heading of diverse books. People can opt into those, as opposed to those being included with the standard shipments of books. And that's in response to just relentless pressure from small minority of people who have apparently been behind these book bans. And then obviously the Don't Say Gay stuff and everything that's happening in Florida and so many other states. So I think you're right. People are very afraid of any kind of representation because it does humanize people. And that doesn't serve certain interests that directly opposes that.
So. Right. And I believe, forgetting, yes, I just looked this up. Adania Shibili, a Palestinian author, wrote a novel about the foundational sexual violence at the moment of Israel's creation, had her Frankfurt Book Fair Award canceled during this time. You know that this canceling and like erasure of Palestinian voices has been happening more in Western media and in the U.S. particularly. And that's exactly what you're saying. You know, there's a big effort to just suppress Palestinian voices, even as far as to go as, say, in Germany, where they're actively banning any kind of Palestinian identity. Waving the flag is seen as anti-Semitic and as being stopped. And it's just in that, it's fascist to kind of claim that one identity should no longer exist or be perpetuated. So I think the best rebellion is to just keep that up. And if you're Palestinian, be proud of being Palestinian. And if you're not, actively seek Palestinian sources and Palestinian voices.
How are you taking care of yourself right now?
Right now? Good question. I had the chance recently, speaking of Palestinian media, I shared with a couple of friends some Palestinian folk music that really gets to me. And even before all of this, I listen to it sometimes when I'm homesick. And it's just the messaging behind it. One of the songs has to do with, one of the songs is a song that's sung for brides when they get married to people outside of their village. It's almost because when you marry outside of your village, you might never come back, or you might only come back on holidays. So it's almost like a song of death, like you're getting married and we're going to miss you. And like, we're so sad, which is, it's in itself tells you a lot about the culture, that there's a lot of loss. We're feeling like even in moments of happiness, there's loss. And then a secondary song, which is very similar, but way older. It used to be sung by Palestinian mothers when their sons were conscripted into the Ottoman Empire army. And it's a song of farewell. And it's similarly a song of like, I might not see you, and my heart will always be with you. And I think it's a common theme in Palestinian media, this fear and longing and loss, that something, you might never see someone again. And when I listen to it, I think of the Palestinian children and people back in Gaza who might never see their families again, who are outside of Gaza, you know? And I know some people here in the States who have family in Gaza who very similarly, you know, have spoken on the phone with their relatives, and their relatives would say things like, don't worry about me, I'm in death right now. Like, I'm already gone. Just take care of yourself and take care of family. I've heard that expressed in the past, and it's horrifying to think about. And yeah, so I guess in a way I've been, even though some might say that I'm putting myself through torture by listening to this music because it evokes this kind of response, but to me it's cathartic because I'm so in tune with who I am and what my culture is, that when I listen to those kinds of songs, I would say that's how I try to take care of myself. While going to the gym, surrounding myself with friends, etc., etc.
Ali, will you send me those songs? Will you send me links to them or the names?
I even translated them into English for my friends, so I'll send.
Wonderful. Please, yeah. Ali, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's always wonderful to talk to you. You know, talking to you, it feels like talking to my little brother, and I don't know. I've been thinking about you and, you know, the other Palestinian people I know and I'm close to, and you're very much at my heart.
Thank you so much, Lena. And thank you for the space. I mean, all of this is just a horrible blip in history, but one that we will never forget. And what makes it easier to digest is the fact that there are people like you who are giving spaces for voices to just speak up and share their stories. So we appreciate you.
Thank you.
I've put the songs, lyrics, and resources that Ali mentioned, as well as ways to take action, in the show notes. Right now, being vocal about what is happening is more important than ever. Use your voice, and please know that speaking out matters. I personally hate conflict and go out of my way to avoid it, and the truth is that the consequences for most of the people listening to this who are not living under occupation are much less serious, perilous, and harmful than they are for the people who are in the crosshairs right now. Gazans are running out of food and water, and aid is being blocked from entering at the border. In this moment, when terrible things have happened and are happening, and more people are about to be killed, silence and bystanding are tantamount to endorsement. My question for you is, what are you going to do?